imagine the absolute worst flu of your life and, you know, not being able to get off the couch and for $20 and a block walk away, you could fix that flu. You would spend that $20 every time to get over that flu. And that's kind of when it, you know, it shifted. It came, stopped being recreational and began becoming an addiction maintenance.
Brandon Johnson here. You might remember me from such places as your television, the internet, or anybody who is paying somebody to do something. I'll do stuff on YouTube or Home Shopping Network if I have to. Welcome to today's episode of Cracked Gets Personal. My co-host is Robert Evans. He runs the personal experience section of Cracked, which has somehow convinced millions of readers to care about things like the Syrian refugee crisis, unrestricted drone warfare, federal whistleblower laws, and other things comedy sites don't normally cover. Now, he and I have partnered up to bring you all-important, baffling, and hilarious stories from around the world. Robert, what are we talking about today?
Drugs, yo.
Oh, shit! I love drugs!
Yeah, but not the fun kind. The kind that are somehow managing to kill more Americans than guns and ride-on lawnmowers combined. Today, we are talking about prescription painkillers, opiates. To start us off, here are some doctors.
Oh, that's an easy one. So the question is, what's the worst drug? And it is definitely prescription opioids, so pain medicine. And the prescription opioids, the things like Vicodin and Percocet, the prescription strength drugs, the United States population takes about 85 to 90% of the world's consumption of that. So either we are in a lot more pain than people in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, or we are just big pansies. But they are things that people get addicted to, and they're hard to get rid of. And I've had patients lie to me. I've had patients blackmail me. I've had patients, you know, threaten me trying to get drugs. We had a patient comes in. She wants more and more narcotics. And one of my partners said, you know what, we're not prescribing this for you anymore, you know. And she says, I got to have this because I sell it to pay my rent. I'm like, well, you know, we can't do that. So she goes out into the crowded waiting room and just screams at the top of her lung, that guy is going to cause me and my children to go homeless because he won't give us our medicine. And so those medications take just an absolute unbelievable toll on society and lots of deaths, you know, some stars in the news. But yeah, definitely the worst thing is prescription narcotics.
That's Daniel Fulkerson. He's a neuroscientist and a former ER doctor. And he was the first person to kind of key me into the fact that maybe we'd be better focusing this podcast on prescription opioids. I also asked Jared, a veteran EMT paramedic source.
Legal prescription painkillers. It is an absolute epidemic. It is completely out of control. There's not enough control measures in place to prevent people from essentially shopping for doctors. You'll go on scene and find people with pain medication, the same medication, same strength or even stronger sometimes, from four or five different pharmacies with filled on dates within a day or two of each other. And there's four or five bottles of this medication at home. And it's all prescribed by a different doctor from a different pharmacy. It's ridiculous, frankly. And if you're talking about one of the biggest problems in healthcare right now, aside from, you know, access to coverage and stuff like that, prescription painkiller overdoses is probably killing the most people aside from natural diseases.
You know, it kills more people than guns in this country.
Jesus.
Yeah, man, you gotta work hard to kill more Americans than Americans kill themselves with their own guns.
Yeah, I also like that woman was so addicted that she was like, I'm gonna be real honest with you. I need this so I can try and pay my rent with this money. We're in the same business. Don't mess with my supply.
Yeah, which is like, I mean, on one hand, I can respect a side hustle. On the other hand, like, doctor's not the guy to tell that.
Also, I can't believe you're that stoned on your medication that you just become real forthcoming about how you get down.
And I wonder how many actors that works on, because it's got to, like, clearly it does on some of them, because there's fucking pill mill doctors out there. You hear about the DEA busting new ones.
I have to show a driver's license just to get Sudafed. Like, if I want to get Claritin D allergy medication, they make me show a driver's license. And I think I have a limit on that.
I mean, you seem fine right now.
I'm on three pills.
Oh.
Yeah, I breathe beautifully.
Let's hear from Sean, a rural physician's assistant, talking about how the opiate epidemic looks in the middle of fucking nowhere.
Out here in Kansas, we have what might be called hillbilly heroin, which is actually just OxyContin. You crush it, snort it, smoke it, inject it, do all sorts of crazy things with it. And it's easy to get a hold of because there's an elderly population here. There's people that get cancer. They're exposed to pesticides. and other things. And so they'll be on these hardcore pain medications, but they don't take them all the time, but they don't keep track of their pills. Their grandkids, their kids maybe, start sneaking a couple. The bottle disappears. Well, grandma says it's just time for a refill. I'll go get my fresh bottle anyway. Next thing you know, the high school kids got it. They're selling it. They're using it. People come into the ER. They're not responding. They automatically think that they're on some sort of narcotic, and likely it's OxyContin.
OxyContin's the big motherfucking mamma jammer of all of these prescription painkillers. And it's the drug that very much started off this whole epidemic. We talked to, in addition to our other medical sources, another doctor, Peter Grinspoon, who can give us sort of the drug-addicted physician's eye on how this problem looks and why it's such a fucking, it's like a tornado going through middle America right now.
It happened pretty quickly?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, just within the last decade, it's leapt from like, oh boy, a lot of people are doing prescription painkillers, to like, oh boy, prescription painkillers are killing more people than all of the other illegal drugs combined. Here's Peter Grinspoon.
The drug, legal or illegal, that has caused the most problems, I would have to say OxyContin, because... Yeah, OxyContin is really, in the 1990s and the early 2000s, what led a lot of people to become addicted to opiates because of the pharmaceutical company Purdue Pharmaceuticals and their advertising campaign and the overprescribing. And that, in turn, led a lot of people to heroin addiction. And I think OxyContin, if you had to put your finger on one drug, and of course, methamphetamine is devastating communities, and crack cocaine devastated a lot of communities. But if you had to put your finger on one drug that has caused the most problems, I would probably say OxyContin.
Everybody has the same answer. I'm gonna throw a little stat dump at us first, just to kind of establish things here. Between 2012 and 2015, the number of opioid overdose deaths in the United States almost tripled. Opiate overdoses kill more Americans now than guns. Around 30,000 Americans each year die by gun from a combination of accidents, dogs, suicide, and homicide. Heroin kills 13,000 people. Fentanyl kills 10,000 people. Prescription painkillers kill more than 17,000 people. Opiates are an absolute epidemic, and so that's what we're drilling into today. And that company he was talking to, Purdue Pharmaceuticals, the people who brought us OxyContin in the first place, well, it turns out that back when they were first starting off selling this stuff, they doctored studies in order to show that, no, it's not addictive at all, like the same thing that tobacco companies did. This stuff, you know, we can give it to people with pain, and it doesn't cause dependency, it doesn't cause any real problems. When they came out with OxyContin in 1996, it made $45 million in sales. By 2000, it made $1.1 billion in sales. That was just in that year. That's a 2,000% increase in the span of 4 years. 10 years later, $3.1 billion. It came to account for 30% of the global painkiller market.
So these people got rich overnight, and there was no oversight. Nobody was looking at, gee, this is strange that this thing goes from $45 million to $1.3 billion.
Yeah, it must have been clear. Like, you can't not have known, oh, we're just getting people high as shit.
Yeah, and I think maybe because they were a smaller company with a couple of local operators, they didn't necessarily fall under the large FDA regulations like Pfizer or Eli Lilly.
Yeah, and they had, I think until 2013, they had a, whatchamacallit, you know, that thing where nobody else can make it. What do we call those?
It's called a patent.
A patent.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. But it's worth noting that in 2007, there was a lawsuit against Purdue Pharmaceutical, the United States of America versus the Purdue Frederick Company Incorporated. And Purdue executives wound up pleading guilty to lying to doctors and patients about the addictiveness of their drug and, labeling it and advertising it as abuse resistant. And so they paid $600 million in fines, which is the largest settlement in U.S. history for a pharmaceutical company, and also a tiny fraction of what they made every single year selling it.
Yeah, I like that these guys showed up for court and were just like, yeah, we're guilty, man. Now, can we get back to moving this weight?
Yeah, $600 million, whatever. Right. Fuck it. We're making like $5 billion on this shit a year.
Exactly.
Yeah. We'll take it.
They should have a rapper that represents them. That's how much drugs they push.
They've killed a lot of rappers.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe it.
Now I want to go back to Peter Grinspoon. Peter's actually the perfect guy to talk to about the opiate epidemic because he's a doctor. He's prescribed this stuff. He watched as OxyContin took off. He's an addiction counselor, so he's worked with a lot of people with addiction. And he is also a former addict himself who got temporarily disbarred, disdoctored, undoctored.
They lose their license.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. Here's Peter.
I'm a primary care doctor in Boston at Massachusetts General Hospital, and I'm an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. I'm in recovery from opiate addiction for 10 years, and I am the author of a memoir about physicians and addiction called Free Refills, A Doctor Confronts His Addiction.
Everybody's got to plug their book. He's very diligent about that, but I don't hold him against him. I wrote a book, and I have to plug it constantly, except for here, where that would be inappropriate. But it is part of the glamorous lifestyle of an author, so let's not judge Peter too much. Anyway, here's how he got hooked.
In medical school, during my third year of medical school, a classmate of mine encountered a bunch of pills, and we looked them up because we didn't know what they were, and one of the packages said Vicodin, and we looked it up, and it said, warning, causes severe euphoria and a false sense of well-being. So that was supposed to be a warning, but once we read that, we were destined to try it. So it was during my third year of medical school that I first tried Vicodin, and it had such an effect on me. I was so euphoric that from that time on, I was, at least for the next 10 years, trying to recreate that initial feeling that I had with the Vicodin.
Yeah, man, it's one of those things, like, the ads don't lie. That shit makes you feel like a goddamn king.
Yeah, it's also the oddest way to sell it. Say, like, this is for pain, but don't use it for anything else, like getting along with your wife or loving your kids more.
Watch out, it'll make you real happy.
Right.
Like, whew, you will be happy as fucking tits, man.
Right.
About 8% of the general population in the United States are addicted to drugs. But for doctors, that rate's as high as 15%. So they're twice as likely to be addicted as the general population. But they're no more likely to snort cocaine than the rest of us. Illegal drugs aren't responsible for the epidemic of drug-addled doctors. They abuse legal prescription drugs because they have access to legal prescription drugs. And nearly two-thirds of addicted physicians say they picked up their drug addiction for the same reason Peter did. Stress.
Well, certainly stress was a big part of it, and that's part of why doctors are so susceptible to addiction. I mean, access is the other part of it. We have a lot of access to medications, which is why I called them Free Refills. But people tend to self-treat stress with drugs and alcohol. But the problem is, then once you start getting addicted, the addiction takes on a life of its own. So I would say that my relationship with the opiates changed, because while the stress was constant, I would get deeper and deeper into my addiction, both physically, mentally, psychologically, in every possible way, emotionally, I was getting more addicted. So I was getting more dependent in every possible way on the opiates, and my ability to function without them was becoming increasingly compromised. So they were becoming more and more the center and the focus of my daily life.
Have you ever, like, felt yourself sort of on the verge of, like, you discover a new substance and you're like, oh, now this could be a fucking problem, two or three nights in a row, and then it's like, I don't know, I've had that happen.
Oh,
where
certainly.
It's like, yeah. It's that finding something that actually, like, cuts through whatever it is troubling you. And then you're like, well, I could just take this every day. And then this anxiety thing isn't a problem anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I started pretty early. So as soon as I found it, I was like, oh, man, this is tits.
Yeah, it is great. And it's like falling off of a building and finding Superman picking you up.
It's like hearing it's okay over and over again throughout your day.
The
very opposite of what anxiety is.
Yeah, but nothing needs to be okay, which is part of what's so fun about it. And when we talked about one of our earlier podcasts, which dealt with emergency medical workers, the fact that doctors kill themselves at, like, between 2 and 4 times the national rate. So I guess it shouldn't be surprising that they also abuse drugs at much more than the national rate. When your job might mean seeing a dead kid every day, like...
Also, you're getting drugs at their best. So
one
of the reasons I think the numbers for their cocaine and street drug abuse is not as high is that those drugs are filthy.
Yeah.
You know, cocaine is a filthy version of what you can get from a pharmacy. And doctors know that. So if somebody handed me clean cocaine and told me that the side effects would be none other than maybe having to take some more clean cocaine, I'd probably get down.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, like, some people have jobs that are fairly easy to function on while you're high as shit. And I think, as a general rule, the smarter you are and the less everyone else understands about your job, the easier it is to function while high as shit. So doctors are in, like, a perfect position there, because I can't, like, as long as my physician's not stumbling into the walls, if he's just diagnosing me while lit to the goddamn gills, like, I can't tell. I don't know what any of this shit is.
And quite honestly, I would argue that potentially a surgeon may be more focused on his job under the influence, because that's the nature of drugs.
It depends on what he's taking, like, right. But I could totally see, I mean, if they were all taking acid.
No. You come out and you're like, I have 2 dicks on my nose, but thank you.
But I mean, it's a beautiful beautiful stitches. Like, right. You really nailed that part. Yeah, here's Peter to talk about that.
I was never actively intoxicated while on the job because I have a pretty good work ethic and a pretty strong conscience. So I'm sure it was only a matter of time, knowing what I know about addiction. But I would say that every night I would be doing lots of opiates, which meant the next day I would be pretty brain dead and sick and hungover and withdrawing. So I certainly was not by any means at my best, at my most empathic, and at my most functional. So I was never, quote unquote, impaired at work, but I definitely was not nearly as functional as I could be. And I also was pretty preoccupied with obtaining opiates. So I was very distracted and very hungover and withdrawing, which is not a great way to be as a primary care doctor when you need to be very focused on the other person. I was very self-involved, as addiction tends to make you. So it was increasingly taking over my professional life as well as my personal life. But, you know, thank God I never actually took pills before seeing patients. But again, with addiction, who knows? It was probably just a question of time. If I hadn't gotten caught and forced to get treatment, who knows what would have happened?
You hit on this a little bit earlier in your answer, and this is really kind of the one of the major thrusts of what we're getting onto in this podcast, which is the fact that medical professionals are substantially more likely to develop substance dependencies than the general population. Can you try to help me understand why that is, like why doctors, nurses are particularly susceptible to this problem?
I think it's multifactorial. Part of it is the stress and the burnout. There's an epidemic of healthcare provider burnout for a whole variety of reasons, and that would be the subject of a whole other podcast about why doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers are burning out and feeling less satisfaction and more stress with their jobs. So we have burnt out and stressed out caregivers. We have this attitude that's ingrained in us, you know, doctor, heal thyself, and a culture where doctors and nurses are not supposed to ask for help and are supposed to be healthy and productive all of the time. And we're supposed to be these machine-like entities that are always available to take care of our patients. And, you know, people often have a hard time envisioning the doctor as being someone who's sick. And I think we internalize that. So we don't take care of ourselves at all. I mean, doctors traditionally make awful patients, and I'm sure the same is true with nurses. There's really poor self-care. And then there's the usual stigma of mental health. And that's probably particularly true of doctors and nurses, because you can get in trouble with your licensing board if you're deemed to have a mental health condition that interferes with your work life or your ability to perform your functions. And it's known that 80% of people with addiction are suffering from some kind of mental health problem, be it depression or anxiety or bipolar. And I think we don't do a good job of getting treatment for our mental health needs. And then finally, you factor in the access. I mean, there are so many pills. When we do home visits, there are pills, people bring pills, patients bring pills into the office, pharmaceutical representatives regale us with samples. There is no end to the access for a physician with a prescription pad to obtain controlled substances. So I think there are a whole variety of factors which make it so that addictions are more common in healthcare professionals than they are in the general public.
You know, I'm glad he said access. I was waiting for access because I thought that would be the first thing that he said. But he left out that new study that says loneliness is a factor, not just being bipolar or having a mental illness, but that just straight up isolation. And you look at the hours that those doctors work, and it's not like after work they're able to kick it.
Yeah. I mean, because you've got like student loan debt. You've got all that time they have to spend 2 hours charting for every hour they spend actually working with a patient. But what interests me, too, is that he attributes some of this to the fact that doctors are basically like, well, I mean, you were talking about like having two dicks on you. It's like double men. Like, men don't go to the doctor because we don't like to complain and don't like to make a fuss and don't want to seem weak. And doctors, like all doctors, are that to the nth degree because it's like, yeah, physician, heal thyself. And also, if I come forward and say, boy, I'm struggling with anxiety, depression, whatever, and I've been taking these pills to deal with it, then it's like, well, there goes your medical license, and good luck with the $350,000 in medical debt you still have to deal with.
Plus, there's this thing, the God complex, that people always try to label doctors as having. But I'll be honest, if I'm sick, man, I want my doctor to have a God complex. I want him to be cocky about how good he is at his job.
Yeah.
And I guess that what goes along with that is you internalize a God complex, and you think, I got this.
Well, yeah, and also, like, what helps you feel like a god more than painkillers?
Yeah, I mean, if I was a doctor and I was high, I might really meditate on the fact that I just saved three kids' lives.
Yeah, and it'd be easy to reward yourselves, too. Like, well, I just saved a human life today. Like, I'm going to pop some oxy. Why not? Who can tell me I don't deserve this now? Which is fair. Like, you should be able to get fucked up in your free time. But I guess the problem is that these things are so insanely addictive.
I would imagine also that if you had a typical college experience where you were doing drugs, maybe when you graduate from college, you're like, I did it, I'm leaving. But if you were a doctor, you didn't go through college like everybody else. It's how you became a doctor. So we're talking about people who are brand new to the drug community in general, trying to mess around with the hardest stuff they make.
You're not hearing about doctors being like, when I was in college, you know, I started taking, you know, acid and I would play around with, I'd take MDMA every now and then and we had, you know, some GHB nights or whatever. Like, it's just, oh, I found prescription painkillers and I was in a lot of stress and that was my fucking good time, girl.
Yeah.
I think that is part of it too, because of course it's safer to just do a bunch of drugs than one drug.
Yeah.
That's my advice for our podcast listeners. Lots of different drugs. Just stay away from the painkillers.
Look, if your drugs are expensive, stop doing them. I've never seen anybody get in trouble with cheap drugs. Unless it's crack.
Or meth.
Right, that's a good point. All right, so listen.
Other than those two.
Listen, do middle class drugs. Don't do anything too cheap. Don't do anything too expensive.
Stick to pot. That's right. Ecstasy. A little bit of acid never hurt anybody.
You want the drug that makes you pass out before you can take more.
Yeah. Yeah, the one with the built-in, boy, we are just
that's awful.
Off the rails here. But no, one of the things, like, if you're already struggling with a problem and some little old lady brings in her expired pill collection with, like, 600 Vicodin, like, that's fucking Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Like, you can either throw that in the trash or you can have a sack of Vicodin.
It's like a savings account all of a sudden.
I couldn't say no to that.
You know, I could say no to it if I knew, and I think this is what they probably figure out, is that it's a cost-benefit analysis, is I got to let this go because in the long run, it's going to be a nightmare. And I've seen it.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me that they don't stop even though they know and have seen the effects. That's the true sign of addiction.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's also something that's made, it's easier to get to go down that rabbit hole when you're a doctor, because if you're just a person on the, like a normal person who comes across some painkillers and you like take what you have and then you want to take more, it's like, oh, do I want to pay $15 a pill for like fucking OxyContin or hydrocodone? Like, no, that's ridiculous. I'll just deal with it. But for a doctor, like, you never have to stop. Like, it's always there. There's always the opportunity, which is not a position anyone else is in with this shit. Like, it's alcohol is like that for everybody, because you can always go to the grocery store or whatever and pick up a six pack or a bottle of vodka. But they have that kind of access to the most addictive drugs on the planet.
What's interesting to me is that he would do opiates at night and then be hungover the next day, when as a doctor, I would imagine that he could prescribe himself something for the hangover.
Yeah, well, but I don't think like an opiate hangover is not like, you know, you hear stories about people who have friends who are doctors or physician's assistants, and they'll set up saline drips for their buddies after a night of drinking, and that works. But there's no equivalent of that for like for being dope sick.
Okay.
Yeah, like there's nothing but dope for being dope sick, like when you're strung out that way.
You hear that, kids?
He is the only doctor with a personal story of addiction that I spoke with for this podcast, but I did talk with two recovering non-doctor opiate addicts who kind of give us some on the ground, not in the hospital perspective on that.
My name is Brendan. I was addicted to opiates for a large portion of my life. Started with pills and things like that, and you know, as it will, escalated into heroin addiction. First time I ever took an opiate, I was 12 years old and had stumbled upon a few 30 milligram morphine tablets.
And that's generally the way it goes. You know, you start with the pills, and then the pills are crazy fucking expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone's like, well, you know, man, you can get some heroin for way cheaper, and it goes a lot further. You just got to be willing to shoot it up. Now it's killing more people than guns. And that's how it goes with a lot of people. Peter started to cope with stress. Brendan started to cope with grief.
It did take quite a long time from those first moments of doing it till I would say I was like full-on addicted, or started escalating things to the heroin. You know, I lost a parent at a young age right before that first time that I tried it, which is where I got that morphine, was from the medicine cabinet of my past father that died of cancer. So that was just available and easy to come by. But when I really started getting into it, I was living on my own. I had a decent job, which allowed me, you know, some money to tinker around with things. There was nothing specifically about my environment that would have been any type of trigger or anything. I wasn't homeless. I wasn't unemployed or anything. I just guess maybe bored. would be the way to put why, you know, what ended up getting me into it. You know, again, looking back on it, it was definitely filling an emotional void or, you know, something along those lines. But at the time, it felt more just like kind of killing boredom.
Yeah, you take a risk because you're looking at your day and you're saying, I can probably mess this day up and still have another 364.
Yeah, and I think that's like an important thing to understand is that like most addiction doesn't look like somebody who's just on the street like jonesing for a fix every day. It's somebody who's able to like work and function, but they're also sort of holding it together until the night when they can, you know, zone out again. Like it's like a Band-Aid. Like it's you've got some sort of hole inside of you, and this is the thing that allows you to kind of keep it from hurting too much on a nightly basis. And it's just about every 24 hours keeping it going.
And his grief isolated him, which is what made him bored.
Yeah. And then there's fucking nothing better than painkillers for boredom.
Yeah. And nobody there to bust him. That parent that died probably was the parent that would have been the most disappointed in him.
Yeah. And then you just grow up and it's a part of your life. Like it feels like some people, you know, develop early on like a habit of exercising or whatever to deal with that anxiety, that like gnawing sense of whatever it is that I think everybody's got to confront one way or the other. But instead of finding something in your life to fill it up, you've got heroin or OxyContin. All right, you wanna bridge us with a joke before we get into our next source here?
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Heroin, don't open the door. No, what was the last thing we said?
Oh, no, that was great.
Was that great?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what we needed. So I kind of asked Brendan, I lied, we're not getting onto our second source yet, but I did ask Brendan how he would describe sort of when he went from just someone who took pills occasionally, recreationally, because he wasn't addicted straight up. Heroin didn't just immediately like lasso him. He was a kid who had access to some morphine, and for a while it was an occasional habit. So here's how he described kind of the dope creep, I guess you'd call it.
I was 12 years old and had stumbled upon a few 30 milligram morphine tablets. By a few, I mean probably upwards of 80 of them. But the first time I did them, I had taken one and then waited probably about an hour and a half and took a second one. Spent the rest of that evening kind of stumbling through the upstairs of my house, bouncing into walls and, you know, banging myself off doors, not being able to stand up quite straight. Woke up the next morning, disgustedly sick, you know, vomiting, went to school, shaking, shivering, feeling terrible, and came home and decided not to eat two and only to eat one the next day just to see, you know, how that went a second time.
And how did that go a second time?
The second time it was a lot more mellow, not less vomiting, things like that. But it was something that until I had stopped taking them and been away from opiates for a while, it was something I was never able to put my finger on what actually it was that I was feeling. And I would have to say that whenever you're by yourself and it's quiet and you start feeling that creeping void from inside of you, you know, it can take the form of anxiety, depression, whatever. It's just that feeling, that uncomfortable feeling of being alone. And opiates managed to just amazingly fill that void so perfectly.
Pain is pain. And the pain of being alone is just like having the pain of a bad knee. So when you're sitting there and you're thinking about how much your knee hurts, it's a nightmare. And when you're thinking about how lonely you are and you can hear it yelling, I'm sure that a pain pill stops that.
Our third and final former addict source, Ed, doesn't blame stress or grief or a void in his soul. He blames a woman, and I'll let everybody judge how
complicit she is in his grief.
Yeah, yeah. How much weight they want to give that.
So my name is Ed, and I am a recovering heroin addict. I started out with pills, and then eventually met a Bathsheba woman that kind of got me into the wrong path, and we started using heroin together. Very quickly switched to the needle after about 3 weeks or so, and that ended up with me going to jail and all sorts of fun adventures.
Don't take drugs with someone until you've been together a while.
Also, that is kind of a move of a sociopath, is that they will get you under the influence early in the relationship because then you've bonded on a molecular level with them. So it's everybody's first go-to is always like, oh, we should do E together. But what it does to your psychology is you have a memory of this person that is not real. And you think it's something that bonded you. I love that this woman is so controlling that she can get him to do heroin. But if you talk to any woman, if they could trick us into doing stuff, it would not be drugs. It'd be like, he's addicted to laundry. He's addicted to getting his socks off the floor. He's addicted to mowing the lawn.
He's been freebasing dishes for the last 4 months.
Oh my God, he's addicted to getting promotions and doing good at work. He was so strung out at one point that we had 2 beach houses and a 401k.
That 401k is some serious shit, Brandon.
Right. I'm on that 401k right now, bro. All I can see is my future. I'm hallucinating. A beach house in Seattle. Trips to Hawaii.
Wait, how do you... Wait, are there beaches in Seattle?
Yeah.
I don't believe in Washington.
That's how fucked up I am that I think there's beaches in Seattle.
Well, it's the west. It's the wrong part of the West Coast. State of the honest parts of the coast.
Is this about drugs or is this about maps?
It's all about maps. All right, let's hear some more from Ed.
Okay, the funny thing is, I actually started when I got my wisdom teeth taken out, and I remember I was like 18 or 19, and the dentist was like, "Hey, you want the good pills?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure." So he gave me Percocet, and I was supposed to take like 2 or 3 a day, and I took like 3 the first time, and like I was just fucking orbiting Mars. And after that, it was just kind of like a love affair, but I didn't get addicted then, but I knew at that moment that opiates were going to be a son of a bitch for me. So it wasn't for another 5 or 6 years. Like when I was 18, 19, I started with that, and then I started dabbling into pills, Percocet, morphine. And then I got to a point where I was actually like, selling perks because they're more expensive, and using morphine because they were cheaper and way cheaper, and the high was like pretty similar. And I was feeding my habit like that. Oh, and then the morphine's turned into methadone pills. So I'd actually done methadone before heroin. And the thing about the methadone pills is they lasted 24 to 48 hours. And before I knew it, I'd been on them for like 2 months and I had a monkey on my back. So I was like, oh shit. So I took all the money that I made, you know, selling and working. I took like $2,000 and I got a hotel room in Seattle of all places and kicked out there just like in a hotel room. Oddly enough, with mushrooms, but never mind that. And I just went out there for like 2 weeks. I didn't know anybody, and I just kicked in a motel room and played guitar on the streets of Seattle to make change and shit, and just kind of like had a good time out there. And I came back pretty much opiate-free, and you know, tried to stay away from them for a good minute. And then I met Sally, as I called her in the article, and she. Well, actually, like when I met her, I had a friend who like was sort of selling heroin, and I would like do it like once a month because it scared me. I didn't want to like, you know, get a habit again. This was years later, and then I met her, and she just wanted to use it daily, and then I just wanted to please her, so I was like, and I kept saying like, "What, tomorrow we can't do it? Tomorrow we can't do it," and then eventually, after a couple weeks, it got to a point. It was like, you know, oh no, we're hooked.
What was the first thing that really changed about kind of your day-to-day life once you were hooked on heroin?
Everything changed very quickly. At that time, I had a car, I had a good job, I had like a career, I was doing really good in life, and then because of the evil withdrawals off heroin, very quickly wasn't able to maintain a job anymore. She like came from a criminal background and a criminal family, so like she quickly taught me the underworld of crime pretty much, and got me into like just all sorts of not good stuff in order to feed our addiction. Because the thing is, like, it starts out cheap, but then once you get hooked, you need more and more and more of it. And eventually some people would be nursing a $60 a day habit, but at my worst I was nursing over $300 a day. And in order to get that money, you can't just, you know, serve tables, or you can't work at a gas station and make that type of money. So you got to do what you got to do. So my entire life changed almost immediately. It was probably within 6 weeks, I went from having a job, a car, to having nothing. And then within 2 months, I was homeless, on the streets.
So in about 6 weeks, he spent about $12,000.
Which I'd be willing to bet most of the people, certainly in my early 20s, I didn't have more than that in savings.
Much less to make it evaporate.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He probably sold a car, I'm imagining.
I mean, that's what he's saying he did, yeah.
Also, she was hot, man. You can hear it in his voice. She smoke fire.
Oh, yeah. And fucking, if he's reliable about the whole criminal background thing, that's pretty hot, too. That's a thing.
Yeah.
Like,
my girlfriend can't even get me to take a shower every day, much less go score heroin. So obviously this woman had a very strong hold that was not just drugs.
No, and also, you know, he admits a little bit early, like, he always had a thing for painkillers, which I get. Like, I have a thing for painkillers. It's the kind of thing I'm at this point in my life now where about twice a year I'll have a friend who's like, oh, I got some, like, two or three extra hydrocodone, you want it? Or, like, I got an extra Vicodin, you want it? And, like, yeah, it's a fun night. It's not a problem. But, man, if I broke my leg and a doctor gave me a big old box of Percocet, like, well, that could be an issue for old Mr. Evans here.
And it's interesting that the conduit was his dentist.
Yeah.
Because the first time I ever took Xanax, it was from my dentist, and she was young, and I asked her, how should I take these? And she goes, well, I mean, I always took them on Fridays.
With a bottle of wine?
Right. Yeah. I said, should I eat before this? And she winked, and she went, it's better if you don't.
And that's one of those things, like, in your case, I'm guessing it turned out well. I'm hoping you don't have a Xanax problem. You don't seem like
it. I don't. I'm terrified of addiction. I'm terrified of it. I grew up with it. So I look at it, and I'm just like, no. Not even two Easter bunnies. I just want the ears, and let's get out of here.
And it is, I think it's probably true that, like, most people who like alcohol won't become alcoholics. Like, they might have a period of a couple of months here and there in their life where you're like, oh, man, I've been drinking too much. I got to, like, cool out a little bit. Like, you realize, like, oh, I've been drinking, like, every night because of stress, so I'm going to sober up and not drink for a couple of months, and then you get back. Like, that's, I think, not crazy uncommon, but everybody's got something that's a weakness. And if you find yourself in a position where there's a person who can get it for you, or, you know, you're a doctor and you have access to it, like, well, then it turns into a problem. Everybody's got some chemical, whether or not they ever come across it, that will unlock something in their brain. And that can be a real dangerous door to open if you go too far down it.
For some people, it's endorphins. That's why they spend hours and hours running and jogging and working out until the point where they're injured and they're still like, oh, I gotta go for a run, even though my knee's blown out.
I'll run on broken toes and stuff. Like, I have to run 20, 30 miles a week. I would say that's still within the threshold where it's not necessarily a problem, but it's also like, it's the same kind of thing. Like, I can see, like, oh, I could totally, this could go overboard for me.
And what a crazy tug of war between mental health professionals and physicians, because mental health professionals know we're making more lonely people.
Yeah.
There are more lonely people, and physicians sort of contribute to that. They need to, it would be cool if the two sets of doctors got together and said, there's a spike.
I think one of the things that might help with the stigma of addiction is if we recognized more of the things that are addictions, because I think most people struggle with some sort of addiction at some point in their life, but it's not chemical for everybody. For some people, it's working out. For some people, it's their job. For some people, it's partying or music or whatever. But like almost everybody's going to go overboard on something in their life. And it's the same basic thing happening in your brain, whether or not it's opiates or paintball, like whatever it is you do too much of and realize, like, oh, I got to cut back on this thing. And I think maybe if we were more open about the fact that we all have more in common with each other than not, it would be easier for people who go over that threshold to seek help, because you're not saying, like, oh, I've got this weird thing and I'm part of this tiny group of people that have a problem and what's wrong with me, but, like, no, we're all, like, walking that tightrope every day with something or another, or a couple of different things, and I happen to fall over the side, so, like, please help me, because everybody knows what this is like. We all have something like that in our lives.
Yeah, and stop making products that speak to that.
Yeah.
Like, if you know that you're making painkillers and those painkillers are becoming drug addictive, then you've made a bad painkiller. That nothing should get past, like, the FDA if it's like, yeah, I mean, it'll take your pain away. You might smack your kids in the mouth a little bit. The side effect is that you might sell your car to get more of it. The side effect is that you might want to move into a one bedroom after living in a house. But other than that, your knee should be feeling fine.
And it's weird to me how long I was just trying to rattle off a bunch of things that can be addictive. And I never talked about food being addictive.
Well, sugar.
But like sugar, but also fat, like fucking, I'd be willing to bet there's a whole lot of people out there who are judgmental of their family, friends, neighbors who get addicted to OxyContin, who eat 5,000 calories a day need to cut back.
People who eat entire boxes of Girl Scout cookies and know that their diabetes is going to get worse.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a country that is overweight, so obviously it's not just drug addiction. For this podcast, it's drug addiction, but we know we have people who are addicted to sugar.
Yeah. And I think everybody who's addicted to anything or who has a potential to be addicted to anything, which is everybody, we have more in common with each other than not, regardless of what the actual monkey is.
Yeah.
But I do think, getting back to Brendan and Ed, one of the things that's interesting to me about their different experiences is that Ed obviously talks about how this thing sort of careened him into the criminal underworld. But Brendan kept up his addiction for fucking year after year after year after year, and he never wound up sinking into an underworld. He never wound up selling his car. And I think it's probably almost more important for us to understand, because I think Ed's story of addiction is something a lot of people expect. I think Brendan's story of addiction is probably more common and even more important to understand, because it's so easy for people like him to hide.
Absolutely. Till the end, I was enjoying every moment of it. You know, like, it's not feeling ill and feeling good went kind of hand in hand. I mean, if I was actually like in the midst of a bit of dope sick and I took, you know, had a hit, it would not just like make me feel better immediately, but I would begin to feel good. And I would get the energy rush that, you know, comes along with it. And, you know, the momentary wide eyes and, you know, looks like, you know, I feel like I felt like I was ready to go and, like, you know, go out and attack the world. And like 2 hours later is when you start, you know, getting real groggy and slow and things like that. But I was definitely still enjoying it, even though I was just staving off dope sick. At the same time, I was still doing it because I was still enjoying it. You know, I would have sat through the week of feeling like shit for to be done with it, but I was definitely still getting something out of it every time that I used.
Talk to me about maintaining like a productive life as a person while on opiates, because I think the traditional image of someone who's addicted is that they're not able to keep this up, but particularly with opiates. There's nothing about being an opiate addict that makes you unable to hold down a job.
I mean, I was fine throughout all of it. Part of it was during the workday, I would just use enough to get by, just use enough to, again, not be ill, have a little bit of energy. And then when I would go home, if I wanted to get higher, I would, you know, do then. Or I'd wake up real early in the morning and, you know, use a few hours before I would go to work, because my favorite hit was always the morning hit. But I worked in a lot of jobs that people didn't notice if you were off here or there. I worked at a law firm for a while, and, you know, I just sat in a cubicle with my face in a computer all day. Then I actually for a while worked in a needle exchange as a drug counselor, and that, I mean, nobody's gonna notice that you're messed up when you're being a drug counselor, because it's just par for the course. The people that you're dealing with are generally three sheets to the wind, or however you want to put it. It was one of those things where I would always try to, you know, keep my wits about me and go on as I always did. One of the things that I started noticing about a lot of the people in my life, that they had never seen me sober, so it didn't matter to them what I looked like or if I looked like I was fucked up, because that's just what I looked like. That's just how I behaved.
Yeah, I mean, oddly enough, the fact that Brendan was able to hold down a job is part of what kept him addicted, because he never hit that rock bottom. He never hit that selling his car point.
And that is that secret part of addiction that sort of whispers to you, don't get caught. If you like what we're doing, don't get caught. And so people don't get caught, and they're able to stay and maintain. But it's not because they're good at it. It's because they're bad at it.
You know? Yeah. It's also, though, like, I think it was really interesting what he said, that he realized at a certain point no one in his life had ever seen him sober. And that's when you realize, like, well, I can keep this going forever. Because, like, if I'm really reasonably happy with my life, and I'm not happy with my life, but I'm high during the points when I would be unhappy normally, so it's fine. What's the problem? I've got this people I love and care about and enjoy spending time with, and they haven't noticed a problem. Like, it's not like you're not like Sheriff Brody in Jaws 2, like, stumbling out of the car and, like, a shower of beer cans coming down after you. Like, you go into the bathroom, you pop a pill, and then you're good to go for another 8 hours.
Yeah.
Here's Brendan again.
At one point, it did just become, like, towards the end of it, it was most certainly just about not feeling that illness, not feeling sick, not being dope sick. I've described it once as being, you know, imagine the absolute worst flu of your life and, you know, not being able to get off the couch. And for $20 and a block walk away, you could fix that flu. You would spend that $20 every time to get over that flu. And that's kind of when it, you know, it shifted. It came, stopped being recreational and began becoming an addiction maintenance.
And that's another really important point, is that, like, to the addict, it's not like, oh, I've got this addiction and it's sucking away my money. It's like, oh man, I feel like shit and I got $20. Like, why wouldn't you?
And I can quit tomorrow, but today I need to get down for just a second, because I got stuff I want to do. I think in the best frame of mind, they're like, man, I got to clean up this place and, like, get my life together. But I also can do that on Thursday, and today's Tuesday. Let's just buy a little bit today and a little bit for tomorrow. And then on Thursday we stop.
Yeah, yeah. I'll suffer through the dope sick during the weekend when I can just sleep it off. And, you know, if you're, especially, I think the smarter you are, the easier it is to deal with something, not deal with something like this, but to get caught by something like this, because your brain can come up with better and better excuses for it. Whereas maybe somebody who was a little bit dumber, had a little bit less going on, would just be like, oh, I just gotta take a week off of work and suffer through this shit.
Right. Or gets caught.
Yeah.
Like, it's so stupid that they do it out in the open, or it's so stupid that they get arrested because they're buying in a weird or odd location. God bless you if you ain't smart enough to get addicted.
Yeah. And in Peter, the doctor's case, the addiction was kind of inextricable from the job itself, because obviously that's how he got his fix.
Right. Well, I put it this way. Back when we were hunter-gatherers, we were starving, and we would take food from anywhere we could find it, and we wouldn't be too picky. And I would sort of say that was how I was with my addiction. I was desperate for opiates, and I would take them anywhere I could find them. And addiction tends to turn off your moral compass and make you very self-centered and focused on your immediate needs, such as finding opiates. So I would search around medicine cabinets when I was visiting friends or relatives. I would write bad prescriptions, which is what I ultimately got caught for. You know, I would steal pills in the hospital, and I would take pills when I went for home visits. Anywhere I could find pills, I would take them. And I wasn't even subtle about it. Toward the end, I was very obvious, and people were really worried, and I just stopped caring. That's how enmeshed in my addiction I was. I mean, it's really sort of embarrassing and mortifying to think about now, how sort of shameless it all was. But when you get so mired in addiction, a certain part of your brain, the sort of opiate reward center, takes over all the other parts of your brain, like the social nicety part of your brain and the polite part of your brain and the morality part of your brain that does the right thing. So I was really monomaniacal, and as such, really, any opportunity that presented itself. And further, I would create opportunities to obtain opiates. Like, I would create social arrangements so that I would have the opportunity to have access to medicine cabinets. It wouldn't just be a passive thing, oh, I'm at somebody's house, let's see if there are any opiates. I would actually create these situations. So the desire to get opiates would even determine, like, who I socialized with and where I went. It really permeated every aspect of my life.
When you say you would create these sort of situations, could you give me a little bit more detail into how you'd go about doing that?
Well, say there was a house where I found a big, juicy bottle of Percocet, and I was able to take some of the Percocet. I wouldn't take all of it because that would be sort of obvious. Then that would stick in my mind. That would burn into my mind as an opiate addict. And then, you know, I would be more likely to want to go back to that house because I would know there was somebody taking Percocet at that house, and there would likely be Percocet for me to obtain. So that would make me consciously or subconsciously more likely to accept an invitation to socialize back at that house with those people, regardless of any other factors, whether I liked those people, whether my wife wanted to go back, whether, you know, we had anything in common. I think that the fact that there were opiates there would really help determine who I socialized with, and which is really crazy. But if I look back on it honestly, I really think that the opiates were determining, the quest for opiates were determining a lot of my behavior. And I think that's pretty typical for people that are mired in addiction.
That's the thing about drugs, is you wind up hanging out with people you shouldn't be hanging out with, and that, yeah, you don't even want to hang out with.
It's fun to, or not funny, funny is definitely the wrong way to put it, but it's fascinating to me that even as a doctor with a lot of access to this stuff through work, he's still rummaging through people's pill cabinets,
yeah,
because that's fucking addiction.
Yep.
They have being able to take it from the hospital and, like, just knowing, oh, if I wait 2 days, some little old lady's going to bring in free stuff, but fuck it, I need Percocet now.
Right. Yeah. Stockpiling it and making, yeah, sure, even though you have access to it, making sure that you have enough.
No, it turns everyone into a dragon, but your gold is, you know, Percocet and Demerol and Dilaudid and, yeah, all that jazz. One of the things that really interests me about Peter's case is that while he was terribly addicted to opiates, he was also prescribing opiates to people. So I asked him how his addiction changed his likelihood to give people opiates, to prescribe people opiates, and here's what he said.
It made me a lot less critical and a lot freer with prescribing them, because I just didn't really think of them as bad or dangerous things, because I didn't want to think of them as bad or dangerous in reference to myself. And there were certain patients, and I mentioned this with a lot of shame, this is probably the worst thing I did during my addiction. There were certain patients that I shared prescriptions with in order to get opiates, which is actually not that uncommon among addicted physicians. I know from having worked with a lot of addicted physicians when I worked at the physician health services. So certainly the patients that I shared prescriptions with, I would prescribe extra to them and then take some back, which is obviously just a horrible thing to do. But I would say in that case, and then in general, I was very cavalier about prescribing these medications. because I just didn't think they were a bad thing, because I didn't want to think that what I was consuming was an immoral or dangerous substance.
It's almost like a fat chef. They are fat because they're constantly dipping into the food and tasting. So when you go to a restaurant, you see a skinny chef, you're like, I'm not going to eat here. He doesn't even trust himself. And with these doctors, I love that he was like, yeah, we can split this. So for the addict that came into his office.
What a great day.
What a great day.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I mean, that's the happy side of this. Well, it's not happy, but it was happy for that addict that day.
Yeah.
Like, and I guess that makes Daniel, the other doctor's story from earlier, a little more understandable. That woman who came to him and been like, look, I need to fucking make my rent with this stuff.
Yeah, she was like, stop fucking around.
Yeah.
I know you get down. I get down. Let's get down.
Because she didn't have it. Like, her odds of finding a doctor who, of saying that and the doctor being like, well, all right, let's work something out, like, weren't terrible.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I like it when an anecdote later on in the podcast makes a story from the beginning make a little bit more sense. Peter got away with all this for more than a decade, and he is right when he says that the crime that finally brought him down was just super, super dumb, which should make anyone who's gotten busted for something dumb feel better, because Peter's obviously a smart guy. He teaches medicine at Harvard, but then this happened.
I wrote a bad prescription for a nanny who has since left the country, and I thought that I uncovered, like, the smartest scheme in the world, because who would know that I was writing a prescription for this nanny and then picking it up and using it myself? Like, how would anybody possibly know? As it turns out, as I mentioned before, this could have been my chance to be on America's Dumbest Criminal. I could have been the star, because it didn't take long for the pharmacist to figure out that I wasn't an 18-year-old woman from New Zealand. And she called me up and she said, is this Gemma? And I didn't know what to say, so I had to say yes. And then she said, what is your birth date? And I didn't know my birthday. And then, obviously, the game was up. And 2 weeks later, the police and the DEA were in my office. So there was, like, no ambiguity. I was caught red-handed writing bad prescriptions. So there really wasn't that much I could say. I was charged with 3 felony counts of fraudulently prescribing a controlled substance. I was fingerprinted and charged with these felony counts, and I had to go to court. There was the possibility of jail time. But again, I honestly think, because I'm white, upper-middle-class doctor, that was never a real possibility. I did get supervised probation for 2 years, and I had to jump over every hoop that my probation officer gave me for 2 years, and I couldn't leave the state without permission, and it was just very, very stressful being on probation. I talk a lot about this in my book, Free Refills. I mean, to go from being a primary care doctor at Harvard to, like, a guy in the basement of the West Roxbury courthouse on probation is really a pretty big fall down in the world. The medical board was not thrilled with me at all because of the felony counts. And they were particularly not thrilled with me because of the fact that I shared medications with patients. And I thought it was really best for my recovery and just best all around to be open about everything that I did and get it out in the open and get it behind me so that I could move on with my life. So I also had a couple slips. I never had a major relapse. So all in all, it took me 3.5 years to get my medical license back. So I was out of work from mid-2005 to the end of 2008. And it was a major uphill battle convincing the medical board that I was ready to go back to medicine. I had so many drug tests, I can't even count them. I calculated in my book, Free Refills, that it was something like 20 gallons of urine that I gave in drug testing.
What a great statistic.
Yeah, to know. Well, of course, he's a doctor, so he knows exactly
how much
he's put down. I like privileges when you can say that you benefited from privilege.
Yeah. No, I like how, I really appreciate how open he is, both about, like, the dumb things he did, about, I think he's one of those people who found out, like, oh my God, I'm like the perfect poster child for a major problem, and the best thing that I can do now that I've been caught is be really fucking clear about what happened. Which you gotta respect.
Yeah, he's correct. He's correct that because he was educated and because he was white, he was going to get a less harsh sentence.
He got a less harsh sentence than somebody in Missouri who gets caught with, you know, an eighth of pot.
Oh, an eighth will get you big time.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, 2 seeds will get you big time in Missouri. Impressive, though, that he turned it around and actually became somebody who discusses it.
Also impressive that he was able to urinate out 20 gallons into those little collection containers, because that is... Like, everyone just close your eyes and visualize that. Even if you're driving, close your eyes. The road will be there when you open them. And just picture 21-gallon water containers but just filled to the brim with piss. I think that would be about a quarter of the space in the room we're recording this in right now. I think it would probably up the temperature by like 10 degrees in here. It's just the hot radiating jugs of pee. I don't know why I'm going on this.
It's all right.
When we do talk about getting clean, I think it's important that any podcast we're talking about, like what opiate addiction is, we have to talk about like what getting clean actually means for an addict. And first off, there's that dope sick. Here's Brendan to talk some more about that.
Back in college, me and one of my buddies, we had very strict rules about our usage. We never did 2 days in a row. We'd always, you know, keep within a certain amount, would never go past that. We've, you know, at that time it was the beginnings of the internet. We started looking at what was actually, like, what amounts were actually soluble at one time in your blood, so we weren't taking more than we would get the effects of. You know, we weren't even thinking about, you know, any type of overdose or anything at that point because of the what we were, you know, the amounts that we were doing were not getting us close to that. And then slowly, I remember the one summer I went home after college, and the first 3 days of it, I just had a terrible stomach flu. Just felt like shit, didn't want to get out of bed, you know, going to the bathroom all the time. And then I realized that it was mild withdrawal. And then from that, it should have been, you know, more of a warning sign to like reinforce the, you know, not using it. But instead, it began to become more of one of those things just to where, you know, they refer to it as like maintaining, where I really didn't want to feel shitty anymore. It just became the easy way out of feeling bad.
It's like the worst flu you ever had, but you mix that with your skin is super sensitive. So anything feels like it's just sandpaper against your skin. You're going from sweating to freezing cold. Sometimes at the same time, you're like hot and cold at the same time. You get goosebumps that are super painful because your skin's sensitive, that go from your head to your toe. Severe nausea, you're throwing up, you're gagging. You can't eat. Major depression, anxiety, in the mental part of it. You get the shits, or you get constipated, or you get both, and you can get all those symptoms at once. Or, you know, some people get different symptoms as well. Like sometimes when people kick, it's mostly just stomach. Sometimes it's mostly energy. Your energy levels are completely depleted. And it's just kind of like all of it mixed together, mixed with you being in such a vulnerable place. Yeah, it sucks. It's not cool. It's not good.
You can like hear almost the edge of panic in his voice when he talks about dope sick.
Yeah, he's flashing back.
Yeah.
He's flashing back as he's, and this is the part that we really don't show you in Hollywood, that most people don't see. What we show is the years of fun. What we show is the byproduct of, oh, I did this drug once and I opened up my brain. What we don't show is, I don't ever want to be that sick again.
Yeah, and it's like even when it's something about that deals with like an opiate addiction, like it's there, you'll see it, they'll just be like scratching like the hole in their arm or something like that, and they get like all jumpy and they'll have like they'll look like a flu, but the way he described, like, it's so much worse than the flu.
Yeah, when you say it's the flu times 10, I understand exactly which. When he said you're constipated and you have the shits at the same time,
yeah. You're basically old. Like, it turns you into an old person for a week or so,
Or a baby.
Or a baby.
Yeah.
You know, the same
thing. Yeah, you're shitting yourself and you're puking on demand.
Yeah. Oh, and that's not all. There are some other wonderful intangibles that come with being high on opiates that make kicking them extra hard and cause some really weird side effects when you are kicking them. Here's Ed to talk about that.
Yeah, there's other symptoms as well. Yeah, if you're talking about, like, all the crazy, like, sex that we had when we were using, because you can't orgasm when you're on heroin. As a guy, anyway, I don't know about women, but as a guy, like that, you just can't orgasm. So, I mean, you can last for hours, which is a plus, you know, depending on the chick loves it. And you love it too, because you just keep going, it's great. And then when you get off the heroin, I mean, super sensitivity, like it's you can't even control it. It's a trip. Like, you'll actually start orgasming completely flaccid. Just, I was like, it's like, whoa, I didn't even know I could do that. And you could go like three times in like a minute. And it actually takes a while for that thing, for your dick to start working normal again. It takes like a little bit for you to, you know, like you could just like touch it and it would like orgasm. Like, whoa, that's weird. Because, you know, the thing is, it's just all so built up in there, you know, because like of all the, especially if you're having, you know, if you're on the heroin and then you're having sex all the time and never orgasming, then it's all just fills up whatever mechanism it is. It's in there.
Yeah.
I thought he was going to say the opposite. I thought he was going to be like, man, it's so hard to get an erection after you are trying to kick.
No, you're a fucking fire hose. Now, you're not getting erections necessarily, but you're coming like a goddamn fire hose. I don't know what else to say.
The question too is like, wow, in rehab, people must hook up crazy because they can finally feel.
Mm-hmm. Do not touch the bed sheets in a rehab, I think is one of the lessons I've gathered out of this. It's like the walls in a submarine bathroom.
That's incredible. Yeah. The problem is you're super sensitive, but you also have diarrhea. So you're not really making a case for this.
No. I guess maybe that makes this period a lot easier for German addicts.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's time for Scattenschrat.
Your bow, Deutschland.
the chat show where we talk about Scat.
Is that your German accent?
That's as good as it gets. At these rates, that's as good as it gets.
let me give it a shot. Dr. German von Deutschland, and I like the pain pills. They make me feel very good. They help with the Scattenkommen, yeah.
I want to know if it's the same for women, if women suddenly are able to orgasm more because they have kicked.
Yeah, we don't have any lady addicts to talk to us about that. But if you want to talk about what it's like having sex as a woman after years of heroin addiction, you can drop us an email at tips@crack.com. Not sure if we'll do anything with it, but we're pretty curious, actually. That's not the only side effects. So we talked to Brendan as well for kind of the stuff he noticed, you know, kicking more of a pill addiction rather than, you know, straight up heroin.
I've always had a very strong sense of smell. And one of those things, like when you're coming back off of it, like every single smell made me ill. Everything that I smelled wanted to make me throw up. I mean, still even now, I can smell ketchup from, you know, rooms away. You know, it disgusts me. But my hearing, like they always, you know, music sounds better when you're on drugs, you know, and opiates specifically, like it becomes a different sounding thing. Not that I would ever, I don't miss the way things sounded on, you know, on heroin or anything like that. But now that you mentioning this, now I'm trying to like starting to like look back and notice things that I've like instances where I've been like, yeah, why I wouldn't have noticed that before.
And this may be a little bit more personal than you're comfortable getting, but I am interested in the differences of like sex before and after getting off of opiates.
To be perfectly honest, when you're on it, it's one of those things that like, you know, between like limp dick or just never ever coming. I had a girlfriend for 9 years. We lived together and we would frequently do pills and things together and other times not. And there'd be times we'd go for hours and hours and hours. Neither of us would ever put it together that it was because we were on such massive amounts of drugs. But that was in the, you know, more in the beginning of the heavy usage time. So I was still pretty good at, like, you know, keeping it up, to put it bluntly. But towards the end, it definitely became a challenge, or, you know, just plain and simple, my lack of interest in it. Sex wasn't that big of a deal to me. But yeah, now coming off, I definitely would say for a while I was hypersexualized, not in any type of like bad or damaging way, but just, you know, getting that loving feeling back, I guess.
So kids, that's the real warning here. If you get addicted to drugs, sex on drugs stops being fun. If you don't get addicted, you can have occasional fun nights where you and your girlfriend take a shitload of drugs together and it's fine. That's what the DARE PSA should have been.
Right. She won't get addicted, but she'll get addicted to what the dick did.
Oh, man.
That's what you want to remember.
If it wasn't going to sound so terrible over the line, I would clap right now. There should be an award for that.
And honestly, that is the thing, is that every drug has a sexual side effect.
Oh my
so
God, yeah.
People go into it and they don't really know. Oh, man. You was talking about it earlier. It's great because people's drug stories start the same. They always talk about how much fun it was and how much the sex was incredible. And then it always goes down to what we all know is inevitable. You will care more about the drug. That's how strong that shit is.
Yeah, and it's a real tragedy because if we all had more self-control, more ability to avoid our addiction. I mean, and some people do. Like, you don't, like, everybody who has sex on painkillers doesn't become a painkiller addict. Everybody who has sex on acid doesn't become I think acid addiction is pretty uncommon. It's like 16 fucking hours. that's a tough one to be like, yeah, man, I was dropping like 5 or 6 hits a day just to get through the afternoon.
I'd almost think that they prescribe low-dose acid to get you off of addictions.
Well, yeah, I mean, they do. And that's actually, we're going to get into that a little bit, but psychedelics like that are a really great way both to have wonderful sex with your partner and to get off of the drugs that you got addicted to because you were having wonderful sex with your partner. LSD, it's like the Swiss Army knife of fucking psychedelics.
Sure.
So I want to kind of get into something. We're talking about like the nature of addiction. And before this podcast started, Brandon, you and I had a little conversation about kind of the differences in how our drug education, how addiction was talked about to us when we were kids getting educated on drugs. And I was, my drug education was in like mostly in suburban Texas in the mid to late 90s through the DARE program. And the thing they always emphasized was the actual addictive character of certain substances themselves. Heroin, you can get addicted the first time, and then that'll take your crack cocaine, you can get addicted the first time. Like all these drugs, that was the emphasis, was like these substances have inherent characteristics that will get you addicted to them, and it can take your life away the instant you try it. And you had a very different drug education experience that I'd really like you to talk about.
You know, I'm from Missouri, and the drug laws there are incredibly strong. There's no way to even carry or transport, much less sell. People do it, but the response from law enforcement is incredibly large. So we were always taught about drugs, not in the, this is what will happen to you if you become addicted. We were always taught the punitive for drugs is so high that it's a straight ticket to a work farm. We were always told, you smoke crack one time and you lose your job and you lose your house, you lose your social standing. So the stigma and the potential jail time were what was always hammered upon us as children before we even got to school. There was always a cousin in the family that, if you're in a poorer community, if you're a person of color, you probably have someone in your family that is either doing time or has had an experience with drugs, because it fans out in poorer populations very quickly. So we were always told these are the societal ramifications of doing this drug, not you'll get addicted and then you'll have to go get help, or you'll get addicted and then these are a health crisis. This was, you really are making a huge mistake in your future and the state is the only recourse.
And it sounds to me like what we're talking about, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but more than a state difference, because Texas has very draconian, like fucking Texas cops will put your ass away for possession, transportation, whatever. I think it's more a difference between white kids and black kids than anything else, in terms of, like, for me, they emphasized this will damage you as a person and stop you from doing things. And for you, it was more this will get you incarcerated.
Yeah, we don't have the luxury because of our positioning socioeconomically to fuck around, basically. Yeah. We're going to need to keep it real honest, and drugs were just seen as another way of getting you locked up.
Yeah, because honestly, I don't think there was much of an emphasis on getting locked up for me, because, I mean, fucking suburban white kids, like, none of us are, like, that's not the threat, but a bunch of, like, I grew up in Plano, where there was, like, when I was in 8 or 9 years old, we had the Texas heroin massacre when, like, 6 kids overdosed in a night, and these were all rich kids, because, you know, you get 50, 100 bucks a week, like, I didn't, but kids in Plano did, got 50, 100 bucks a week in allowance from their parents, and they'd spend it on fucking heroin, and then really strong heroin comes into town one night, and 5 of the kids are dead the next day. But that was the boogeyman, is this will kill you, this will destroy your body.
Whereas what my father always told me was that he had a friend who had been selling a lot of cocaine and decided to turn into a government witness, so that he lured 2 more dealers into an apartment, and they put him in the closet while these 2 dealers talked about what they were going to do with him. And although he was wearing a microphone and the FBI and DEA were in front of the building, they were unable to rush into that building when those 2 drug dealers decided to kill this guy. So the entire thing was recorded. They knew exactly what was going on. He told me another story of a guy who was a doctor who had gone for a jog, who had also become addicted and started selling. And then in the middle of our city, they killed this guy. So what we always heard is that drugs won't end you because you do them. Drugs will end you because you're around them.
That's fucking fascinating.
Yeah, it's different. It's different when it's a commerce angle. It's different when it's you will lose your freedom, not you could potentially destroy your liver.
Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting how you're educated on drugs can change sort of how you feel about addiction. Because for a long time, I did think that it was like a characteristic of the drugs purely, that just some substances are like fucking fishing hooks and they get inside you and they pull you up. And there's certainly an aspect of that, like physical addictiveness is like a thing. But there's a study called the Rat Park Study, which was conducted in the late 70s, published in 1981, was essentially a revision of some earlier studies on how heroin and other drugs affected rats. So basically they would have these rats locked alone in a cage, and the rat could either kind of push button, get heroin, or the rat could, you know, get food or water or whatnot. And what they would notice is that a lot of these rats, when they would get addicted to heroin, would just do heroin until they died. They would eschew food, they would avoid water. And so that was sort of the basis for a lot of the science, and like, well, no, these individual substances are so dangerous that they just take bodies over and minds over. And then they conducted the rat park studies, which is where instead of keeping these rats alone in a tiny little cage, they built like a huge playpen open area for rats where there were a bunch of rats and they could all socialize and cuddle and fuck and play on stuff and just like live normal rat lives. And they still had access to drugs, and some of the rats would still do drugs, but they wouldn't do drugs until they died. They would just, like, get high every now and then and go play with their friends. And so one of the kind of conclusions that we can take from the rat park studies is that addiction is not entirely a matter, or not even mostly a matter, of the substance's qualities, but of the quality of life that the addict has, of loneliness, of isolation, which is something that we've heard talking to all of our sources earlier today, and of course something science is increasingly observing. And I talked to Peter about this, and while he thought the rat park studies were very valuable, he did caution me from making the assumption that that study has the whole story either.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think that a lot of people correctly describe part of the problem and then state that they've got this radical new theory of addiction, which tends to be partially true. And I think the rat park experiments certainly highlight a part of the problem, which is that if you're isolated, you're more susceptible to addiction, and that an important component of treatment is social connectivity and community. I completely agree with that. I think that proponents that use that argument to downplay the physical effectiveness or the physical addictiveness of the drugs make a big mistake, because they're obviously, like, very addictive physically. And it's just not true that the physical addictiveness isn't a large component of this. And if you downplay the physical addictiveness of the drugs, you therefore downplay the importance of medication-assisted treatment such as Suboxone and methadone for opiate addiction, which is by far the most proven effective treatment for opiate addiction. And you have to ask yourself, why would medication-assisted treatment, replacing the drugs with a medication that reduces the cravings and stimulates the receptors, why would that be by far the most effective treatment, way more effective than any of the 12-step programs or all that stuff, if the rat park theory was really all of addiction instead of just being a part of the story? It doesn't make any sense. So I think that the rat park studies show that the isolation versus social interaction is definitely an important component, but it certainly shouldn't overshadow how important the physical addictiveness of the drugs are, and that you sort of have to take an eclectic approach to addiction and understand that all of these different experts, some say it's a learning disorder, some say it's about isolation, some say it's about the physical addictiveness of the drug. I try to take an eclectic approach and borrow a little bit from each of them and try to take the truth from each of these theories and realize that nobody has the whole answer, and that addiction is a very, very complex, multifactorial thing, and that you can't just reduce it to one simple theory.
Yeah, or raves would be full of sober people.
Yeah.
Instead of people on ecstasy. And people would just have to make more friends instead of having to sober up.
Well, I think part of that story is that just as isolation can make drug addiction worse, being around a whole bunch of your friends can make drug use better.
Right.
Which is another part of the story.
Yeah.
And since I already had a couple of former addicts on speed dial, I asked Brendan and Ed what they thought had played more of a role in their own addictions, the inherent characteristics of the drug itself or the circumstances of their life. Here's Ed.
You know, I had been seeking out other stuff to kind of fill the void within myself for forever. It was just kind of a natural progression for it to turn into the hardest drug. I mean, even when I was dabbling, I wasn't really dabbling. Like even when I was experimenting as like an 18-year-old, I was still using more than everybody because I was, you know, I was not prepared to deal with things like emotionally or deal with things mentally. So, you know, because of that, the only way I knew how to cope or how to deal with anything was to numb it out. So I would numb everything, so I didn't have to feel. Like once you are hooked, that's a different story, because once you have that physical addiction, especially to something as hard as heroin, I mean, it's just absolute hell. You absolutely have to have the substance, otherwise you go through a crippling pain, just crippling pain that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy, you know. So I guess what led me to the addiction was, like, you know, 80-90% what was going on in between my ears. Because when I was addicted, I realized I could see my life deteriorating, and I realized I didn't really like who I was as a person anymore. So I didn't want to do it, but I had to, because of the pain of withdrawal.
Yeah, and I think he actually really nails it there, is that when you're talking about, like, what does Rat Park get right, it's that what makes you susceptible to addiction is loneliness and emotional isolation. But like Dr. Grinspoon said, you can't ignore the physical component, and that's what keeps you hooked.
Yeah, these people saw themselves turning into people that they didn't want to be and still knew that they had to continue that road, which is something that everyone should hear, is that, honestly, it's not that people are trying to be jerks and say, don't have fun. We just want you to have the kind of fun where it doesn't take you 3 years to get over. Nobody would go to Disney World if they knew that, oh my God, the first 2 days are going to be great, but on that fourth day, you're going to have to come back into Disney World. And if you don't, it's $7,000.
Yeah. Let's try and keep the Disney analogies going. Because yeah. Actually, they are sponsoring this podcast. Disney brand Percocet. They come in 40 milligram, 80 milligram, and 120 milligram Minnie Mouse doses.
Yeah. Maybe you've heard of the Matterhorn. This is the it really don't matter horn.
God damn, Brandon. You're on fire.
Brought to you by Hempcott. Hempcott Center. Come on in, man. We'll figure out what y'all doing here once y'all get in here, man. It's a party, man. Sponsored by Five Flags. We had six, but man, we had to sell one of them flags just to get you what you need when you get in this park.
He's just gonna keep going.
Not Roxbury Farm. Come on in to Roxbury Farm, where we got every kind of thing you want in a rock format. Cocaine, crack, everything. Are there any rides? Used to be.
Okay, I have to cut my addiction to hearing you keep riff.
Ballmart. God damn. You want drugs? You'll suck these balls. Ballmart. You're in a whole different Universal Studios. Bring your kids. We'll take care of them. Question mark.
Okay. Here's Brendan answering that same question before we get on the, I don't know, like Euro Disney.
I know myself personally, I have a fairly addictive personality. I mean, I smoked cigarettes for 17 years. I now use a vape to try to get myself off of that. I have been and still am a pothead. I love the Shulgin research chemicals. But the opiates, they definitely were, you know, to use the phrase, like they were in a class of their own. The reasons I used at first, you know, to myself, I would lie and say it was definitely because I just loved getting fucking high. And when I look back on it now, I really think it was just because I was emotionally stunted, looking for something that I didn't know. Like, again, it was a search I didn't even know I was on. Opiates are painkillers, and it kills pain physically and emotionally. And I didn't even realize the pain that I had in my life, that I didn't even realize it was there, let alone that I had been covering it up with these painkillers for as long as I had been. So again, I mean, the chemical dependency, like, it sucked. Like, and that I would blame on the chemical itself. But the reason I kept using was, again, because there, you know, even when I'd be clean, what would get me back going, or again, were those quiet times when I was sitting by myself and that creeping emptiness from inside me started billowing up again, and I'd be like, fuck, I gotta do something. And I knew of a quick fix, where now that I've gone about things differently, I can sit in the quiet by myself for long periods and never have the thought of going out to use. Like I said, it's different, it's weird, but I think what kept me going was was me, not the drugs.
And what got him sober was filling that void in his life with love.
Oh.
But at one point, I met someone that kind of, it was somebody that I couldn't afford to lose. I couldn't stand to see myself lose, especially over like a drug. It made me weigh my options. It made me weigh the pros and cons of everything. And I took my last hit one day, and the next day I just decided I was going to sit there and deal with whatever I deserved for having been on it as long as I could. Or as long as I had been, I was going to go through the withdrawal because something more important than I don't even know what I would call my pleasure, my selfishness is what it came down to. But I found something that was worth more to me than my selfishness. And from that point, it's, you know, I had tried getting clean a few times before. I'd gone several months, you know, just the way you do, you know, everybody knows that opiate addiction is not a good thing. So there's times where you're just like, yeah, I shouldn't do this, or, you know, maybe I should try to clean up. And sometimes it was just like, just to prove to myself that I didn't need it, I would go for a few months without using. But this one, this was different. This time that I got off, it was, I put it down and I walked away, and it was, I felt different doing it, and I felt different ever since. But it was, again, that void that I had been attempting to fill the entire time with that drug. It's now just been filled. It's, like I said, it was love and family, and I have those things now, and that void is now filled, so I don't need to fill it with anymore, with opiates anymore.
And we all know that there is a chemical release when we love someone. And when we hug someone, and when we kiss somebody on the mouth, we know that there's a chemical release. And it's interesting to hear somebody be like, you know, I moved on to something, but I moved on to something that was sustainable.
Yeah, oxytocin beats OxyContin.
Yeah.
The rate of heroin overdose deaths in the United States increased 286% from 2002 to 2013. Most of that surge is directly tied to the painkiller epidemic. For many opiate addicts, the pills eventually become too expensive, and eventually heroin just makes more economic sense. Brendan and Ed both went from pills to horse. And I asked Brendan to kind of walk me through how that change occurred for him. Like, what sort of the process was from going to, I'm going to crush up some Percocet and Raylum, to I'm going to shoot China White into my arm.
Taking a pill, even when crushing up and snorting a pill, it's still... It always seemed, you know, again, you're like, well, it's not the needle in my arm. And early on when I had tried it, I definitely, probably around 13, 14, had definitely filtered some, you know, dissolved and filtered some morphine through a cotton ball and, you know, mainlined that just to see what it was like. And it was incredible. But I definitely had put that away and didn't get back that until I got into more heavy use. And that thought of, well, I'm not putting it in a needle, was definitely almost hyper present in my mind. When I was taking handfuls upon handfuls of pills, and, you know, feeling the kidney or my kidneys begin to, you know, get sore because of the amount of fucking acetaminophen that I had in me, not even the opiates, just like, you know, the binding agents, things like that, from just the massive quantities of pills that I was taking, you know. And then the transition, I don't even really know how, when that happened. I mean, there's definitely a romance behind the needle. But that was never a big part of it for me, because, as I said, I tried it when I was younger. I understood a little bit about it, you know, not anywhere near what I would later on in my life. I mean, I'm trying to think, because I don't even remember if I started buying heroin and snorting it. I'm pretty sure I just went straight to getting heroin and shooting it. And then I, you know, a few times after that, I would get pills and I would, you know, crush those up and shoot them and things. But I was still at the early stages of it, still taking, or, you know, just eating pills. But, I think once I started needing more than the pill, or, you know, needing a larger availability than the pills were able to provide, started being able to find the heroin better or more readily. If you're getting heroin, you may as well mainline it. Like, I don't know, it was a weird switch where it just went from popping pills to shooting it. Like, I never really went through a huge phase of sniffing them or anything like that. Just went from eating pills to shooting dope.
You did so many drugs that your kidneys hurt. That is insane.
Yeah, that's real messed up. And it's also like, I don't know, what's really interesting about sort of the process he walks us through is that he's giving us a good overview of how the opiate crisis got so bad. Because it's not the way it's commonly portrayed, where people get into illegal drugs and, you know, they start smoking pot or whatever, or start taking ecstasy with their friends on the weekends and then degenerate into being heroin addicts. It's they get prescribed medicine, or they steal prescription medication from a family member, and they get hooked on the stuff that is safe and measurably dosed, that they know exactly how much they're taking, and when that gets too expensive, heroin's the only option. And that's why it's so tough to fight this, because you're not fighting people buying drugs on the street from sketchy dealers. That's the end of the problem. You're fighting people getting drugs from their doctors that are going to kill them.
It also removes any sort of glamour where people are like, yeah, we're starting off in a sweet spot, but you definitely end up in your bathroom tying off. It is not the party.
Mm-mm.
No.
No, no. I mean, by the time you get into heroin, like, that's not a fun party drug. Like, that's the weird thing to me about all the emphasis on, like, busting up raves and stuff, is that, like, if people are doing drugs with a bunch of their friends in, like, a well-lit-up, happy party atmosphere, they're probably not the people who have a big problem. It's the people who are taking stuff alone in their bathroom that are going to wind up overdosing and dying. It's the people who are taking it to maintain rather taking it to party. Like, party drugs is the opposite of the problem. The problem is what happens when the partying stops.
Also, it would seem like the lonelier you get, it's like you were saying, it's like you're at a rave, you're doing drugs, for a reason. Mm-hmm. It's helping you kick it with other people, you're dancing, you might meet somebody. But that point when you're in your own house and you're just doing drugs, like you are working on carpentry or like you're putting a puzzle together, it seems like the one thing that is a huge factor in all of this is I didn't have anybody to kick it with in the first place, so it wasn't like me staying at home all weekend was a big deal.
Yeah, the drugs were never part of like a fun lifestyle for you. It was never like, oh, I take drugs when I'm hanging out with my friends or when I go to concerts or I go to festivals. It was, I got prescribed these drugs. And it's really comfortable to just be alone at home on a shitload of painkillers. You don't mind that you're alone at home when you're on a shitload of painkillers. And that's what's insidious here. The government always focuses on busting the big parties and on busting the people selling those party drugs. But that's not what gets people into trouble. What gets people into trouble is doing pills alone in their living room and then inevitably transitioning to doing heroin alone in their living room. That actually leads me to another point, because we're talking in this one about how legal drugs like opiate painkillers get people into horrible trouble and have caused the greatest public health crisis of our time that's not related to Cheetos. And our next podcast is actually going to be about how illegal drugs are helping to mitigate that problem. So you've got on one hand the legal, very profitable prescription painkillers that are causing more deaths than firearms in the United States. And on the other hand, you have drugs like LSD and MDMA and good old-fashioned Mary Jane that are helping to not just fight the opiate epidemic, but to fight some of the other great health epidemics currently burning their way through our country.
Cracked Gets Personal has been produced by Robert Evans, Brett Rader, and Alex Schmidt. It was engineered and edited by Brett Rader. Next week, we're wrapping up our conversation about drugs in America with some doctors who are offering some realistic solutions and a soldier using MDMA to treat his PTSD.
I'm noticing these changes start to occur to my surroundings, and I'm thinking, okay, what the hell did I just do? What did I sign up for? What did they give me? Is this even MDMA?
For Robert Evans, I'm your host, Brandon Johnson. Thank you for listening.
Oh, hey, everybody. I'm Dave Holmes.
And I'm Matt McConkey, the sidekick that Dave Holmes never wanted.
You're not a sidekick. You are a full co-host.
Oh, please. I should be so lucky to have
that
title.
Come on. We are on an equal footing here. And homophilia. It's all about us, me and Matt, talking to a wide variety of LGBTQI+ exclamation point individuals about their lives, about their pop culture diets, what they're watching on TV, what they're loving, and
who they're loving. Who so they're loving. We're going to take a deep dive into their personal lives, ask some very intrusive questions, you know, about what their current dating status is, how did they come out, what was their biggest heartbreak, what's going on in their Grindr account? Can we see their Grindr account?
Can we improve their Grindr account?
Oh, yeah.
We'll be releasing new episodes every Friday.
Homophilia is coming to you beginning Friday, August 11th, right here on Earwolf.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.